strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg.
This week on the show, earnings season is now in full swing, as is the new year. But the pace of the news flow and market action hasn't seemed to have slowed one bit. At the same time this past week, the cyclical and small cap trades started to peter out as mega cap stocks made a run yet again. Head fake or a reversion to what's been the norm for so long?
And Sarah, we will revert to our norm and finish the episode with the craziest things we saw in markets this week. And by all means, if you're a listener and you saw something crazy, give us a call on the Bloomberg podcast hotline at 646-324-3490 and leave us a voicemail and maybe we'll play your crazy thing on the show. I got a pretty good one, Sarah, and it's not even Bitcoin related. My first non-Bitcoin crazy thing in a while.
In quite a while. I trust that's a Price is Right then, though.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah,
of
absolutely.
Course.
Get ready.
Your signature.
But before that, we'll talk about the serious things facing the market this week. And we're very happy to have on the show the head of equity strategy at Wells Fargo Securities. His name is Chris Harvey. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Sarah. Great to be back.
Great. Chris, I want to start off by saying I'm pretty sympathetic to strategists who are required to come out with a year-end target for the S&P 500, because I feel like you can make 100 great calls all year, get all the sectors right, get your factors right, get everything right. But wise Alex like me are just going to ask you about that target. And, I can't help but notice this week, S&P reaching 3850, which is actually your year-end target. So I'm curious how you're thinking about it. Are you tempted to go back to the drawing board on that? Or is it these one of those examples where the market's just gotten ahead of itself and you're sticking with that type of forecast?
So, Mike, we like to get things done ahead of time. So we figured, let's get it done the first 3 months of the year.
Congratulations.
Right? Why not?
Take the rest of the year off.
Everyone waits another 12 months. Let's get it done. Let's get it out of the way and let's go forward. Right? But what we do is we knew this is a very conservative target, and we prefer to have, we bias ourselves on the conservative side. We make very conservative estimates. Last year, we also had a lower target than the marketplace. And one of the things that was different from us is we had a lot of confidence in it. We never cut our price target. And when things got really dicey, we found real value and we felt comfortable in and around the market lows, telling people to put money to work. Also, at this time last year, we ran into a similar situation where people are saying, hey, Chris, are you going to raise your price target? What are you going to do? No, we said no. And right now the answer is no. But we also know we have very conservative EPS estimates. Part of that was we don't know what the tax regime is going to look like. It's a long year. And we'll see. And we have no problems raising our targets or changing when the information changes. What we really don't want to do is we really don't want to cut our target, because we don't want to tell people there's value there when there really isn't. And so we tend to err on the more conservative side. Like I said, we like to get things done sooner rather than later.
You get right to it. But Chris, something that wasn't so conservative on your end was you and your team were very early to this cyclical value small cap call. I mean, way ahead of the pack. And we've clearly seen it play out over the past couple of months. Lately, there has been a bit of a topping off where we have seen big cap tech come back. We've seen small cap start to underperform. From your perspective, are we going to see this continue, or is the catch-up trade that we saw at the end of 2020 and the beginning of 2021 as well? I mean, was that what you guys were looking for? Was that all said and done?
Well, a couple things there. We had a heroic fourth quarter, last couple months of the year, with regard to small caps and high COVID beta and cyclicality. To start the year, small caps are now up, I would say, somewhere around the high single digits, if you will. Right, we're closing in on double digits. Pretty good return. We think it continues, but obviously you're overbought here. We got a very big bounce from the sweep in Georgia, as people think that it's going to be more stimulus and more steepener. And what we need to see is we really need to see the fundamentals fill in. And for that to occur, numbers just have to come out. And so a bit of the consolidation, a bit of the back and forth, sure, that's not unusual. That's something we expect. But we still think there's another good 6 months to this trade. What I would say is we thought there was a good 12 to 18 months in this trade. But with stimulus and with the sweep in Georgia, what we think is everything is now accelerated, right? And the window is much shorter. Everyone's going to be concentrated. But valuation is still attractive, easy comps. And I think we're going to have a very healthy M&A cycle, which should help the group.
Yeah, Chris, it's a great point where you made where you said we still don't really know what the corporate tax situation is going to be this year. I mean, I think it's clear that Joe Biden was inaugurated on Wednesday. The honeymoon doesn't look like it's going to last very long. Already there are some some Republicans coming out, even the moderates like Lisa Murkowski and Mitt Romney coming out and pushing back at the size of that $1.9 trillion stimulus plan from the White House. Obviously, I think it's safe to assume they will push back at the tax corporate tax increase, too. I mean, is it too early to sort of start reading the tea leaves in Washington about what we can expect from Biden when it comes to taxes and spending? Or are you, as we sort of begin to see the administration take shape, are there any takeaways yet that you have that kind of, can illuminate what you're thinking about as far as stimulus and taxes?
As far as stimulus and taxes, the issue here is we're going to get more stimulus, right? Now the question is it $1 trillion? Is it more than $1 trillion? How much more? For us, we don't care that much. $1 trillion, pretty big number, right? And you get that money into people, and what we know is it works. It's successful, and we're no longer talking about whether the vaccine is going to come out. It is out, and now the question is when people want it or are capable of getting it. Right? And I think by June or July, the situation is going to look much different. But to get to the tax situation, one of the reasons why we say the window of opportunity is much shorter is it appears to be a rent not owned type situation. We're super cheap, right? And frugal as a day is long. We don't want to stick around for the bill. You're going to have to pay that bill. You're going to have to do that before the midterm elections. So that's saying somewhere in the second half of this year or the beginning of next year. And so, we can talk about taxes. It's hard to say granularly what's going to occur, but we know that we've spent a lot of money and sooner or later we do have to pay the bill and we think it's coming. And so unlike a lot of my peers, I'm a little bit worried about that because that's not going to be a whole lot of fun. Usually when you raise taxes, it's not great for the capital markets and it's not great for risk product.
So what's the allocation scenario for that then? I mean, the understanding right now, at least as I've understood it, is that there are many who are still unsure if we're actually going to see a big change in the tax code, just considering that we did see a blue sweep by a very narrow margin. Then at the same time, it's difficult to know what policy is really going to be in focus, when it might hit. So when you guys think about policy proposals that are going to be coming down the pipeline over the next 2 years, over the next 4 years, when clients are possibly asking you about these changes, how soon do you have to actually start implementing allocation strategy to mirror what might happen when you're unsure at the time? And what would those changes actually look like?
So Sarah, it's a great question, right? What we're looking at and what we typically use to lead us into an allocation change or regime change is the market is telling us. We look for a repricing. We've seen that repricing in bond proxies, in low volatility strategies, whether it's utilities or REITs or what have you. Then what we need to do is we need to find a catalyst, right? And at this point in time, we don't have that catalyst. What we think is by the summertime, we'll start to hear the talk of tax bubble up. That's the beginning of it. By that point in time, we also expect to see small caps having outperformed even more. We expect a lot of the good news that in and around earnings and fundamentals to be reflected in price. And we expect to see another leg up in the euphoria within the marketplace. And that will give us the opportunity to make that shift, that repricing, that catalyst, and that timing juncture.
Yeah, Chris, I'm curious if you're bullish on small caps, what's sort of the best approach to executing on that? Would it be just a sort of a passive vehicle, an ETF, or would you you know, if you're an average investor who sort of doesn't want to get into the nuts and bolts of all 2000 stocks in the Russell, would you find an active fund, or, you know, how would you sort of go about expressing a bullishness on small caps?
So a bullishness on small caps, if you're a retail investor, there's probably one of two ways to do it. You can do it in some open-ended mutual funds, and I would look for funds that will provide you this exposure, but with low fees. Or you could do it on an exchange-traded mutual fund or ETF, right? And those are pretty tax efficient. The fees on those are quite low, and you can get in and out rather quickly. So I prefer, because of liquidity, an ETF. But some people, if you're going to buy and hold it for some period of time, mutual fund also makes sense for a lot of retail investors. But you're right, buying 2,000 stocks of the Russell is probably not your best use of your time.
I feel like whenever we talk about small caps, oftentimes, especially the skeptics, bring up the term zombie companies, and especially coming off the back of COVID-19 and worries about insolvency or debt repayment and companies not being able to bring up the cash that they need to actually move forwards from this point in time, even if we are going to see a rebound in earnings. There's a concern there. So from your perspective, would you say that the concern about zombie companies at this stage is overblown? Particularly in the small cap space, or is it just a situation where if you're going to get into investing in small caps, you just need to be aware of the risks that are at stake?
Sorry, I think the risk is overblown. And I think I had a conversation recently about bankruptcies and the whole creative destructive process. And there were many companies that did go belly up or go bankrupt. And we needed that to clear out certain things. And we needed that creative destructive process to reach a final end. I think there's more to go. But as far as investing in small caps, I don't see, if you look at the exposure, you look at the names in there, I don't think you have an obscene amount or even a significant amount of zombie companies or zombie risk there. The other thing to think about and to know is that if you're a public company, access to the capital markets, credit is widely available. And if you want to issue stock, you can issue stock, but if you want to issue debt, you can do it at very low rates and you can do it in significant size. So liquidity is really not an issue at this point in time. And I don't think the whole zombie risk is a big issue for smaller caps.
Hey, Chris, I wanted to get back to your year ahead note and a few predictions you made. One is very provocative, so of course I'm gonna key in on that. But you wrote that Tesla in December of 2020 echoes AOL in December of 1998. Boy, that's gonna put some shivers up some spines, I think. But walk us through, sort of unpack that for us. Why you're making that comparison?
Right. So we're getting lots of things, getting the spidey senses starting to tingle, right? I remember 1999, I remember 98, 99, and I remember what was happening. You had a lot of speculation. You had a lot of retail investors getting involved. If you recall the phrase, I think it was E-Trade, click it in there, Stuart, right? And we have a lot of funny things going on now. But what was amazing to me is AOL at the time was a game changer. Right, it's an amazing technology. The stock had an incredible run, a run that I really hadn't seen before, and it was going into the S&P late in the year at a very large market cap or a very large weighting. Okay, that to me was the beginning of the end. Right, 99 was a fantastic year for stocks, but after 99, many of your tech companies, many of your growth companies, lost 50 to 100% of their value. Now you have another game-changing technology, right, in Tesla, right, and you have a stock that has performed amazingly well, and it's going into the S&P 500 when December, late in the year, at a very large weighting or market cap, right? What this signals to me is this growth at any price. This is signaling that we're close to the end of the growth at any price type investment strategy. Right, it's not a call on a particular stock, but what it shows you is that we've reached a level. And so back in the late 90s, it took 12 months for the regime change to occur. And what I'm telling clients now is in 2020, everything is accelerated. Right? Everything that I thought was going to happen more or less occurred, but just in a very compressed time period. So if it took 12 months, back in the late 90s. We think it probably takes 6 months now for that regime change really to occur. And it was more, this is a signal. And what we're seeing, you know, funny enough, is I think the big pain trade for a lot of people on the buy side is a recovery or a strong recovery, because many people haven't traded in a post-recessionary environment. Many people have been trading in a low growth or recessionary environment. And when growth is abundant, different things happen. The market rewards value in small caps and cyclicals. And that's could cause a lot of pain for much of the buy side because they're so steeped in that growth trade.
All I can hear is that AOL noise from back in the day, you know, the beep, a dong, a dong.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, I still have an up and running AOL email.
Do you really?
I do. Wow. I don't use it, but it exists, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. It's embarrassing.
you still have the floppy drives? Remember that? They used to mail out
I don't have that
drives.
Anymore.
Yeah, you'd get like 5 in the mail a day. And,
Chris, I want to ask you, though. So if you believe that Tesla and its addition to the S&P 500 marks a shift from this growth at any price regime, do you also believe that it signals a possibility that what we're experiencing now ends in a dot-com crash fashion? Something I find so amazing is that we have heard since June that many times, many people saying the market's in a bubble, there's plenty of euphoria. Then we go on to the summer, then we see retail traders buying options. We hear it again, that the market's very euphoric. We hear it again in December, and all of a sudden we're in the new year and months have gone by, markets have gone up how many percentage points since the original euphoria calls, and we're still sitting here. So even if that were the case, I mean, what can you even possibly do?
Right. So again, there's a lot in that question. There's a lot to unpack. And I'm going to, like all good equity strategists, I'm going to talk my book a little bit, and I'm going to say, I told you so, right? I had to. But I gave you the disclaimer, right? So at the beginning of the summer, what we told clients is we're expecting a market melt-up. We're expecting a 10% plus run. And what we said is we don't expect to sell off until we reach higher levels, because as we go higher, that makes the foundation a little less stable. We hear a lot of the talk about speculation and bubbles and so on and so forth. I've been through several bubbles. Yeah, it's true that there's a lot of retail investors, and I have friends that now, in theory, trade better than George Soros in his heyday and all this other stuff, right? But where we are, right, if you go back to late 90s, we were heading into a recession. We've already had that recession. And if you go back to late 90s, there were many companies that really didn't have a business model. It was things like clicks and eyeballs and so on and so forth. A lot of big tech, a lot of big growth, the underlying fundamentals are good. And what we're arguing about, what we're talking about, is relative value, relative performance. We think it's just stretched too far at this juncture. Typically, when growth works, it is in a lower growth, a lower rate environment, and it's because there's a scarcity value and there's no alternative. Well, now you have an alternative. The growth for many of these small cap and mid cap stocks going to be, we think, quite impressive. We think the reaction function is going to be quite strong. And what we think is there's probably a two-tier market, which is what you're beginning to see. And one of the reasons why we haven't been so euphoric on our price target is we can see a big rotation up the capitalization with the Uber caps, where people do rotate. A lot of the Uber caps just trade water or perhaps even sell off as people use them as a source of funds. But it's not this massive capitulation because the underlying fundamentals are actually okay. You will see certain strategies, whether it's momentum or other things, have some difficult time. And we'll see some, you know, double-digit corrections at some point in time. But I'm not in the camp that we're in a bubble and this is terrible and it's all going to end in a very sad story. There's a lot of good values out there, but it really is more similar to the late 90s, down the capitalization, in those mid caps, in the places where COVID has really had a significant effect. And as we go forward, what you pay for something is going to mean a lot more. And if you're trading at 150 times earnings, yeah, some of these stocks will work, but most of them probably don't. And you could see a really healthy correction in some of these high flyers, if you will.
So Chris, a lot of people listen to this podcast solely for my brilliant cryptocurrency analysis.
It's true.
It's true. Right. That's a lie, actually. Whenever I mention it, people, I think the listeners roll their eyes and shake their fists at their phone. You did make an interesting call on crypto in your look ahead piece. Let me read it here. Resurgence of interest in crypto as a preferred speculative instrument further presses the topic of institutionalization of digital assets. I'm curious if you could unpack that for us a little bit. I hear further institutionalizing crypto, and I worry, well, does that bring with it sort of systemic risk along for the ride? So I'm wondering how you see that shaping up in 2021 as far as the, you know, institutions embracing crypto. And, you know, if I can throw one more in there, if, you know, Gary Gensler as the, if he gets confirmed for the SEC, if that plays any role in how that all shapes out, you know, the best I can tell is he probably knows more about crypto than probably most government regulators. I'm not sure if that ends up being good or bad. I he's kind of a two-handed economist with it, as far as I can tell. But how do you see it all shaping out in 2021?
Yep. So how do I see it all shaping out? It's still very murky, right? But the point that we were trying to make at the end of the year is cryptos are here, and people are beginning to accept them more and more. Whether you look in the NFL and an NFL player wants to be paid in crypto, right? Whether you look at when I go out and I talk to people, one of my associates is a millennial. She and her friends have been involved in cryptos for some time. And now what you're seeing is some of the larger institutions talk about it, say we're going to put it in our mutual funds. And there is a more of an acceptance to it. Right. And so what you would expect to see is more regulation, but more liquidity. You should expect to see a lot of volatility, right? There has been and continues to be a lot of volatility, but over time that volatility to come down somewhat. And I think what you would also expect to see is a winnowing out of a lot of, there's a ton of cryptos out there. I think what will happen is there will be some sort of consolidation and you'll have just a handful of cryptos that people really want to transact on. But it really still is, you know, and I don't want to be evasive, but it really still is wide open and it's just developing so quickly. And the point being is it's going to be accepted to some degree. It has lots to change. There's lots to do, but it's an exciting part of the market. But by the same token, a lot of people are using it, we think are using it to speculate, and that could cause a lot more volatility as we go forward.
But when we talk about institutional acceptance, I mean, even just this past week, for example, BlackRock came out and filed these updated prospectuses to make Bitcoin an eligible investment in two of their funds. So just shows, I mean, people are clearly thinking differently about it. But Chris, before we get to sharing our crazy things, there's one more 2021 prediction that I wanted to call you out on and then ask you if it's made you kind of think about any of your other predictions. And that just being the one that's already occurred about the Georgia runoffs, the idea that you had predicted that the GOP would retain Senate control. We're now, when this runs, 22 days into 2021, cross one off the list. Are you second guessing any of your other top 10 predictions for 2021 at this point, or is it too early to say?
Not second guessing. So again, full disclosure and full responsibility and accountability, we were wrong. Right, we expected GOP to hold on to the Senate, but to be quite honest, we weren't wrong by very much. And I have to say that it's helped our book. It's helped small caps. It's helped high COVID beta. It's helped the cyclical trade more so than I ever would have thought. With regard to the rest of our prediction, it's a long year. What we tend to do is we want to be more than 50%. Last year, I think we were somewhere around 70, which was a great year. This year, yeah, I can't say it feels good to lose one right out of the gate. But by the same token, it's really helped our book a lot. And I think, you know, the point that we were just talking about, this is more kind of for what we're trying to do is predict things that, you know, have a high degree of probability that are a little out there, but have a high degree of probability of occurring. And the crypto is a good example of that. So, yeah, a little painful. But not going to change just yet on the next nine.
And I will say a hit rate of 70% in 2020, which I think many people were surprised by the entire year, is pretty impressive.
I was going to say, I like that Chris grades his previous year, and 70% is, you got to grade these on a curve. 70% is pretty darn good, I think, for this type of thing. If you're, like you said, if you're above 50, you know, you're winning.
Yeah, I would be lying if I wasn't surprised as well. I was looking for 55 and we got 70. I was like, okay, I'll take it.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, Sarah, I think it's that time. Have you come prepared?
I did come prepared. I always come prepared, Mike.
I know. I'm just trying to increase the drama a little bit.
Does that mean I'm kicking us off?
Yep.
All right. So I don't have a Price is Right, but I do have a bit of a trivia question for you. If you had to guess, what's the best performing stock in the S&P 500 this year? What would you say?
Oh, man. Best performing. I know the worst is Twitter. If you're a short, the Twitter is the worst. The best performing. I'm gonna say one of the banks. I don't know, though.
All right. Good guess. Chris, do you have any thoughts?
I would say GameStop, but I'm not sure if GameStop is in the S&P 500. So let's go with Western Digital.
All right. So a bit surprising, at least I was caught off guard. Your best two performing stocks in the S&P 500 this year are General Motors and Ford, and each is up more than 33%.
Interesting.
What a change.
Wow. That's quite the change.
I mean, there's been a lot of talk of technological investments and Microsoft teaming up there with GM and getting into the autonomous car space. But still, I think, clearly, as we just discovered, I think many people would be surprised by that. What, and granted, you know what the year's very young, but...
You know what I wonder is it back in the day, it used to be every day there was a different speculation about who was going to buy Tesla. Maybe now everyone's speculating on who Tesla is going to buy. Just throwing it out there.
That's some good speculation, Mike.
It's one way to ramp up production. Just buy Ford, GM, Volkswagen. They could probably buy all of them at this point. It's secondary offering and just take out the entire car industry. Now, don't listen to me, listeners. By the way, none of that's going to happen. That's just me. That's my prediction for 2021.
We'll see. He's going to bank his entire prediction set. He'll get his 0% or 100% if he gets real lucky.
Well, that's a good one though. I did not know Ford and GM. Interesting. How about you, Chris? You witnessed anything crazy in the past week or so?
So one of the craziest things I've seen over the last couple of days and over the last week has been the reaction or the performance of some of the heavily shorted consumer stocks. These stocks are going up many days at double digit returns. And the amount of short or short interest in these stocks is obscene. And so I think this can continue, but I haven't seen this kind of movement in a number of or group of stocks in a long, long time. And it is very consistent, and it speaks to heavily shorted stocks being covered and covered rapidly.
Yeah, and I'll elaborate on this a little bit more, just because I know you. When I asked you what the best performing stock in the S&P 500 was, you guessed GameStop. And GameStop, I mean, just a couple of days ago, or about a week ago, on the 14th, short interest as a percentage of shares outstanding was 81%, and now it's already come down to about 67% or so. And like you said, I mean, it's almost, at least last week, every single day, 27% gain, 57% gain. I mean, it's remarkable to watch.
Yeah, it's amazing to me someone would short a stock that's already that heavily shorted. I mean, I don't know. Have you not heard of these guys on Reddit that are going to take you to the cleaners on this by now? But that's pretty good, though. And I wonder, you know, Chris, I wonder if it's just people looking at the vaccine coming and stimulus coming and just getting overexcited about these consumer names to some degree.
I think that could be part of it. There could be some liquidations that are going on. And obviously the fundamentals are changing and that's all playing into it. But you're right. When you're that heavily shorted, funny things can happen. And that's exactly what's occurring.
Well, that's pretty good. All right, Sarah.
I'm ready for Price is Right.
Ready for Price is Right. We'll see how Chris does at the Price is Right game here in the alternative asset space. And this is really alternative, Sarah. You know those little stickers you get on a banana? You know, it'll say like Dole banana.
Yeah.
Like Ecuador, Panama, wherever the banana
was printed. Don't tell me that banana stickers are now being auctioned in some strange marketplace.
Sort of. So one of those stickers ended up on a $20 bill. And it wasn't just placed there by someone. It was landed on there during the printing process of this $20 bill at some, you know, government printing facility in Texas in like 1996. To the point where, you know, that little the seal of the Treasury and the serial number are both printed over top of the Dole banana sticker. And you can make your own jokes about banana republics if you want. I will not make that joke. But so my favorite part about the story, and this is on CNN.com, by the way, is the theories on how it got there. One guy saying, well, it might have been sort of part of their quality control process. Someone put it on there to see if it could get through, and they forgot to weed it out. Another guy's like, nah, I'm pretty sure it's just a joke. Someone just did a practical joke, put the banana sticker on the 20, and it got printed. Of course, as you can probably guess, that $20 bill is now up for auction. And collectors of these types of things love mistakes like this. Like if you're collecting a coin or a piece of currency, if there's some mistake involved, it totally raises the value of the item. And clearly this is about as hilarious as mistakes can get. So what's the bid, Sarah? If you're playing Price is Right, what would you bid for a $20 bill with a banana sticker embedded into it underneath the Treasury seal?
All right, not what I would bid, but maybe what one of these fanatics who love mistakes would bid. I'm going to go with 900.
900?
Okay. Yeah, I'm keeping a $20 bill.
I'm going to keep my poker face, but Chris, what's your bid on the $20 bill with the banana sticker?
Since I love Bob Barker and Price is Right, I'm going to go 901.
That's how you play the game, Chris. That's how you play the game. Exactly. That's how you play it. The current bid, and this is Heritage Auctions in Dallas, current bid, $57,000.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
And there's like some seller's fee too. So it's closer to 69 or the buyer's premium, they call it in these auctions. So 60-70 grand for the $20 bill with the banana sticker.
The last few times around, I had done really well with learning my lessons about overshooting. And now after today, I'm going to start overshooting again, and then I'm going to start being way off once again.
Wise move. I love the 901. That's how you play it. That's this guy's.
Congratulations.
We got to get Chris on Price is Right. Sponsor him.
All right. Well, Chris Harvey, winner of Price is Right. We'll have to catch up again sometime soon. And also at the end of 2021, so we can see if you get that 70% or higher hit rate again on your predictions for the year. But Chris Harvey of Wells Fargo Securities, thanks so much for joining the show today. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reg Anonymous. And you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Also, thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.